It's really great to have you all back again. I hope this has been helpful.
My picture's always going on OG.
Okay, great. So now, again, some kinds of evidence for Christianity is something we can use. Oh, am I muted? Okay. Didn't know I was muted.
You gotta unmute.
Okay, great. So some kinds of evidence that we can use in Christianity are useful for creating faith, are useful evangelistically. For example, I believe the class that we had last week would be really great to share with anybody who's marginal in their faith, not sure if they believe in the Bible, not sure if they believe in Jesus. This lesson is not that kind of evidence. You're not going to help anybody become a Christian by showing them a picture of a ancient statue or something like that. So when we talk about history, archaeology, and the Bible, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to essentially defend our faith. And you'll find if you spend much time on the internet, there are a lot of people who are very, very skeptical of the Bible, and they'll say things like, you know, the Jews were never in Egypt, and Abraham, that's not an actual person, and nobody really believes that David was a king in Israel and things like that. So history, archaeology, and the Bible does two things. Number one, it illustrates. In other words, when you see the actual object, I think that helps kind of give a concrete nature to our faith. It kind of illustrates the stories in the Old Testament, number one. But more importantly, at least in my opinion, is it's kind of like an inoculation about skepticism, and people say all kinds of stuff. If you take your Bible 101, which I like to call Blasphemy 101 there at Arizona University, the professor is probably going to tell you all kinds of stuff. Oh, you can't believe the Bible. It's just a bunch of stories. This is typical. And so the purpose then tonight is to undermine this false narrative about the reliability of the Old Testament. I'm going to tell you the conclusion right now, which is the Bible is by far, with no close second, the most accurate and reliable account of ancient history we have. And that would be by comparison to Thucydides and Herodotus and Tacitus and any other well-known ancient historians. Okay, for some reason, this happened last time too. My PowerPoint's not working, so they'll just take me a second. I don't know why this happens every once in a while, but it's not going to take long for me to fix it. Sorry about that, but okay, I have to go to exit full screen and then make this smaller. Sorry about that. This will just take me about 30 seconds or so, maybe a minute. You think I would have solved this by now? Okay, back to Zoom. Share screen. Sorry about this, folks. Should work now. Ah! All right, I'm going to do it by hand. So let's talk about history, archaeology, and the Bible. Now, the first thing is we have to kind of get a picture for the different time periods in the history of Israel, the period of the patriarchs, which is the earliest period in the Old Testament that we can start to assign fairly definite dates. We can say when Abraham lived within, you know, plus or minus 50 years or so, the period of the patriarchs, that would be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and then the period of Moses, Egypt, Israel being in Egypt, the exodus from Egypt, and then in the conquest, that would be around 1450 to a little bit after 1400 BC. Then there's the period of the judges, from 1400 to around 1050, the period of the United Kingdom, first under Saul, then under David, and then Solomon, and then with Rehoboam, of course, the kingdom split. And then we have the period of the divided kingdom, the northern kingdom conquered in 722 BC, the southern kingdom conquered by Babylon in 586 BC, And then we have the period of the exile, the 70-year period of the exile, roughly. And then the return from exile after Cyrus, and then the Persian period. Now, a question, it's kind of a rhetorical question. I normally ask this as an actual question, but you all are muted. Just look at that time period. When would you start to see actual physical items that you could dig up out of the ground and say, if what the Bible says is true, then we ought to at least reasonably expect we could actually find a physical object? Would it be during the patriarchs, the time in Egypt, the judges, United Kingdom, divided kingdom? The answer is, only with the United Kingdom could you expect to find actual archaeological sites that would provide evidence related to the Bible. The reason is, Abraham lived in a tent. So what if you found evidence of Abraham, like a tent? You know, what about in Egypt? They were slaves. What would the Jews being Egypt leave behind? What about wandering in the desert? Are you going to find some footsteps or something like that? Even the period of the judges, the Jews did not build cities. You get the sense that they were just barely hanging on by their fingertips. Only after the time of David are you likely to see actual physical items you can dig up and look. So before that time, the best we can do is we can look in ancient history and see, is the information in the Bible consistent with the place and the time and the culture? For example, if Genesis is a reliable historical record of what happened, then the things that you see in Genesis should be consistent with what was happening not in Israel, not in Egypt, but in Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. If the story of the Exodus and the wandering in the desert is consistent with history, if it's accurate history, then it should be consistent. The things you read there should be consistent with culture, history, and customs in Egypt. Okay, so those are the kinds of things we're going to be looking for. All right, these are some dominant powers at different times. I'm not going to spend too much time there. All right, here's the ziggurat in Ur. So now I want to talk about the time of the Old Testament, Genesis. Now, if you read, starting in Genesis 12, you read about a city called Ur that Abraham lived in. The sense you get from Genesis is that Ur was a very large and prosperous city. Then Abraham went from Ur to Haran. And Haran, as you read the account, seems to be more of a smaller city, a little bit more on the frontier, if you will, of Mesopotamia. Well, it turns out both Ur and Haran have been discovered and dug up. And it turns out Ur was the largest city in the Mesopotamia in the period around 2000 BC. Prosperous, fitting quite well the picture of what you see in Genesis. But on the other hand, Haran, which is a much smaller city, in the far northwest section of Mesopotamia, in what would be sort of like eastern Syria today. And what's interesting is Haran was conquered and destroyed roughly 1600 BC. Now you have to understand, a lot of the critics of the reliability of the Bible say the Bible is a bunch of stories written around 500 BC, at the absolute earliest 600 BC, representing not actual history, but just people's prejudices and fables and stuff like that. If that's true, then how did they know about the city of Haran, which would have been buried and unknown for over 1,000 years? That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And then you go to the Ebla tablets. Ebla is another city never occupied by the Jews. There's no Jewish archaeological sites there, but it's interesting. The city of Ebla would be also in northeast Syria. And there is what's called the Ebla tablets from around 2100 BC. And most of these tablets, they're clay tablets, you can see in the cuneiform. Most of the things are record tax records and, you know, wheat harvests. But interesting, four of the names found on the Ebla tablets are Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai. By the way, that is not the biblical characters. I mean, it almost certainly is not. It seems almost impossible to believe it was. What that proves is Nahor, Terug, Abram, and Sarai were common names in northern Mesopotamia in 2000 BC. Now, to illustrate how important this is, let's say somebody dug up a letter, and he said this letter was written in 1850, and the names are like Constance and, Brittany and stuff like that. You go, that letter's not from 1850, Brittany? On the other hand, if you read a letter and they said, yeah, this letter was written, yeah, a friend of mine wrote it to me in 2014, names like Gertrude and Harold and stuff, you go, that's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. And Nahor and Terug, you know, again, the skeptics of the Old Testament reliability would say the Genesis account was written over 1,500 years after the supposed fictional character Abraham lived. Well, how do they explain the fact that the names reflect something that was coming from Mesopotamia at that time? By the way, I'm not claiming the book of Genesis was written down in a written form in 2000 BC. What I'm saying is the content, it accurately reflects events that happened at that time through an oral tradition. All right. But there's another interesting story in Genesis where Jacob and his wives and his concubines are fleeing from Laban. And Laban chases them all the way through the desert, not to get his daughters back, not to get his camels back, but to get the seraphim, the idols, back. It's like, what's that about? But they found an inscription in Mesopotamia from roughly 1800 BC that said, those who possess the family idols possess the inheritance. Aha. So again, what we see is a custom that is found in the Bible, which makes no sense other than in the cultural and historical setting of Mesopotamia of approximately 2000 BC. Now, the next piece of information also relates to Genesis, Genesis 14. Now, if you read Genesis 14, Abraham and Lot had a discussion about who gets the good land. And Abraham was very unselfish. He's up in the highlands of Judah. And he says, Lot, you get the really good land. You're going to go down to the Dead Sea. Now, if you were to go to Israel today, if you went down to the Dead Sea, you would say, why would anybody want to live here? It is one of the most desolate places in the world. It is hotter than Phoenix and drier than Phoenix, if that's possible. All right? But the Bible describes five prosperous cities, including Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboiim, and Phoper. And so there's this five-city league, which joins up with Lot to fight a battle against Chedorlaomer from Elam. And you know, again, typical of the critics of the Bible who don't believe anything unless you absolutely prove it to them, and then they don't get the general message. I'm going to talk about that in a bit. So obviously, you know, nobody could possibly believe this biblical account. I mean, it's ridiculous. In fact, it is so desolate and barren there that essentially no archaeology had been done at all by anybody until fairly recently. There was an archaeologist decided, well, let's go take a look. And what he found out was in 2000, in the period between 2000 and 2500 BC, the area was wetter than it is today. It wasn't some lush tropical jungle, not at all. It was relatively dry, but there were a number of wadis. And those are intermittent streams that only flow right after rain. But back then, these things flowed all year. And what they discovered is at the mouth of these wadis, there was a massive irrigation and very intense agriculture going around, going on. Guess how many cities this archaeologist discovered? You guessed it, 5. All 5 of them destroyed at almost, for all practical purposes, at exactly the same time by fire. None of them ever occupied again. In fact, the entire region basically was never occupied, at least for agriculture, after that time. Now, as a Christian who believes in the reliability of the Bible, I kind of go, well, of course. But you have to understand the skeptics, you know, well, anyway. Now, what's interesting is the largest of those cities, which is almost certainly Sodom, it's Bab Adra, they call it. Outside of that city, about a kilometer away, there was a fairly large cemetery. And the cemetery had these wooden structures that had been burned at the same time, and they were burned from the top to the bottom. Now, normally when you burn down a city, you burn it from the bottom to the top, not from the top to the bottom. Now, I'm not even going to come close to say this proves anything, but this is very suggestive of, you know what I'm talking about, right? Read about it in Genesis 14. Okay. In fact, these are some of the ruins from Sodom. Okay, let's go to the time closer to the kingdom period. The Bible mentions the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Girgashites, the, you know, all these ites. And again, you know, a typical of those who want to attack the reliability of the Bible. Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, Gershonites, blah, blah, whatever, you know. Seriously? Nobody ever heard of these people? These things weren't even written until 500 BC. Talking about something happening 1,000 years before, give me a break. This is not real at all. Now, the one mentioned the most about of all those is the Hittites. They're mentioned 47 times in the Old Testament. And again, atheists are just generally, even honestly, people who are supposedly believers in the Bible, but probably not really, said, oh, okay, well, whatever, you know. Well, and then Hugo Winkler in 1906 was doing some archaeological digs in Turkey, and guess what he discovered? He discovered the city of Hattusha. Hattusha was a large city, and it was the center of a great empire known as the, guess what, the Hittite Empire. And we now know that there were dozens of Hittite cities. In fact, the three powers in the period of around 1000 BC, the three great powers were Assyria, the Hittites, and the Egyptians. All right? And here is the gate of Hattusha, the city, the capital city of these people that supposedly didn't even exist. In fact, there are a couple of universities you can actually get a doctorate in Hittite studies. So now even the archaeologists are beginning to admit maybe there are the Hittites. Now, of course, they still don't believe in the Jebusites and the Gershonites and all those other ites. But I'd say at some point, it seems to be that we should start admitting every single time historians and archaeologists discover something from that area, it's always, without exception, consistent with the biblical story. It never disproves it. It always supports it. So at some point, we should begin with the presupposition that the Bible is an accurate account of history. All right, the papyrus Ipuwer, found in Egypt. Proof? Going too far. Suggestive? I would say so. For example, in the papyrus Ipuwer, it says, the river is blood, which sounds like Exodus 7:20. It says, blood is throughout the land of Egypt. It says, the trees are destroyed. It says, the land has no light. And it says, he who places his brother in the ground is everywhere. Is that a record of the plagues in Egypt? It's consistent. Proof? I wouldn't go that far. Okay, what about the Exodus and the conquest? Now, people will tell you that there's literally not a single archaeological find that confirms Israel being in Egypt or the Exodus or the wandering of the wilderness. I want to tell you that is actually a fact. But of course there isn't. What would you find? I mean, a peasant's home? How would you know that was a Jewish peasant's home? So what they're telling you is there's no evidence about something that common sense says there wouldn't be evidence of. So that doesn't tell you anything. That is far from saying that it didn't happen. It's also far from saying there's no evidence that it happened. For example, what we have is the Tell El Amarna letters. El Amarna was a city built around 1400 BC. All right? And they found a number of tablets there, kind of like in, you know, the earlier one, the Nuzi and the other tablets. And basically what these are is a trove of tablets that came from minor kings that were living in what we call Palestine or Canaan. And most of them have everyday sorts of stuff, tax records and, you know, government affairs and things like that. But one of the Tell El Amarna letters has a very interesting account, and I'm going to read it. You can see it on the screen. It says, the Habiru plunder all lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if the archers are not here, then the Lord, lands of the king, my Lord, are lost. Who do you think the Hapiru might be? Do you think that might be the Hebrews? All right. In fact, I believe if you go to the biblical record, you'll find out whether Pharaoh sent archers in time to save the cities of Hazor and Bethel and Ai and Jericho. What about Jericho? Now, the archaeology of Jericho is fairly complex. And we need to be careful about making really, really strong statements. All right, for example, they say the walls fell out. Well, some people say yes, some people say no. I think you might want to be a little bit careful. If you're going to start making claims about how archaeology proves the Bible, I think, you know, just look carefully at your source. You know, but here are some facts about the layers from the late Bronze Age period, which would be, you know, the 1600 to 1300 BC area, the very late Bronze, early Iron Age. The city was strongly fortified in the late Bronze Age at the time of the conquest, like 1400 BC. It was massively destroyed by fire, again, roughly 1400 BC. The walls collapsed at that time. Earthquake? Trumpet blast? Don't know. Apparently, the destruction occurred at harvest time because there were large quantities of grain in the storage houses at that particular layer. By the way, there's dozens and dozens of layers. If you go to Jericho, it's an incredible thing. But we're talking about the layer that's consistent with 1400 BC. Apparently, the siege was fairly short, again, because there was grain still stored there. And whoever destroyed the city, for some reason, didn't plunder it and remove the grain. So how much of that story is consistent with the biblical story? And how much of that story is inconsistent with the biblical story? Well, I would say it's all consistent with the biblical story. Proof? Well, I would say what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a cumulative case. And at the end of this lesson, we need to ask, What does the cumulative case say about the historical reliability of the Old and also the New Testament? Okay, oops, it's not working. Here's the Stela of Merneptah, found in Egypt, 1230 BC, which actually mentions the Israelites, the tribe of the Hebrews, in Canaan at that time. Now, that's about 150 years after the conquest. Again, I'm telling you, until archaeologists find something like this, they will not even admit there was such a thing as Israel. until fairly recently, skeptics of biblical reliability says there was no Israel at all in, say, 1000 B.C. Well, now we have evidence of Israel, definitely. 1230 B.C., that's for sure. I'm going to skip that cool one because there's too much stuff. Here's the Moabite stone. It's in the Louvre. This stela was created in 870 B.C. by Misha. And you can read about Misha in 1 Kings 16. He's a real person. And it mentions Ahab of the house of Omri. Now, how many people here believe there was such a person as Ahab? How many believe that Ahab was one of the kings in the dynasty whose first member was Omri? I believe that. Now, how many atheists and skeptics believe that? They say, we can't trust the Bible because these are just a bunch of stories and fables. All right, so again, we have this. Now, one thing to note is we don't find things like this in Israel. You'll never find a statue of David or of Solomon or of any of the ancient Hebrew heroes. Why not? Because they didn't exist, right? No. Because what did it say in the law of Moses? To not make these kinds of images. It's a little bit frustrating, but it is evidence, I guess, at least, that that law existed at that time. It also explains why certain things we wish we had, such as carvings and bas relief carvings of these people, we had them. By the way, we do. It's just that we have to go to other places. We'll see in a minute. Here's the Tel Dan inscription, made in 820 BC in the city of Dan. There are actually two cities of Dan. This city is the one in the far northeast of Israel's territory. It's one of the two places where Jeroboam set up those idols with the bull idols that they worshipped. And this was not part of the wall of the city. Basically, what it was is a wall that was built significantly after this time. What they would do is they would just take rubble from the area. They built the wall. And just by random accident, this was one of the rocks in the wall. A friend of mine, John Wilson, is an archaeologist from Pepperdine University. And he was in the city of Dan the very day that this was discovered. In fact, he actually walked by this rock that morning, but it was because the sun was at a particular angle, you could see what was written in there. Anyway, here's what it says. This is the king of Aram who is boasting, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. This is sort of awesome, isn't it? Okay, now we already believed in Ahab, right? That's not a problem. There you go. That's not new. We do know that Omri's house continued after Ahab to Jehoram. And also Ahaziah, who's one of the kings of the southern kingdom. And apparently Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, was the great-great-great-great-whatever grandson of guess who? King David. So this tells us that King David was the head of a rather long line of kings. Now, you and I, we're not surprised, like, duh. Obviously, I mean, how could you not believe that King David was a real person? All right, well, you have to talk to the archaeologists about that, okay? By the way, almost everything that happened in the Old Testament, we can't prove that it happened. That's the fact. You cannot prove that David killed Goliath. What proof would you have? Oh, wait a minute. We have it. It's called the Old Testament, the most reliable document of ancient history that we have by far. So it doesn't take a whole lot of faith to believe that David killed Goliath. But don't expect archaeologists or skeptics in general to go there. They're just not going to do it, and that's just the way it's going to be. By the way, what's interesting is, if you look in 2 Kings, Second Kings says, no, actually it's not true. He did not kill Jehoram, son of Ahab. He injured Jehoram, son of Ahab. Jehoram fled the site of the battle, and Jehu killed Jehoram. Now, I've got a simple question, and I'm telling you this is a super easy question. Which is more believable, the king of Aram's account, which says that he killed Jehoram, or the biblical account, which says he injured Jehoram and Jehu killed him? I'm telling you, that's the easiest question you could ask. It's so obvious that the biblical record is more reliable. And yet people refuse to admit that. Well, why not? Okay, like I said, there are no bas-relief carvings of Israel kings found anywhere in either northern or southern kingdom. Oh, but if you go to Nineveh, the stela, the black obelisk of Shalmaneser, actually don't go to Nineveh for that. Go to the British Museum. Well, I remember I took that picture, the one on the right there, and I remember when I took that picture, this is so, oh my goodness, it's like a kid in a candy shop. But you can see in the one on the right, you see that guy bowing down, and then we got a close-up here, all right? And so what this is, it shows Jehu bowing down to King Shalmaneser. How do we know that? Because the inscription below identifies him as King Jehu. Now, in 2 Kings 17:3, it does not say that Jehu went to, Babylon, to Nineveh, to bow down before the king. In fact, it's very likely he never actually did this. Basically, it's a symbolic representation of the fact that the northern kingdom, that Israel, paid tribute to Shalmaneser. Maybe he went there, maybe he didn't. All I know is, now we have a feeling for what Jehu looked like, how reliable it is. I don't really know, but I think probably when it says in 2 Kings 17:3 and following that Jehu basically submitted and paid tribute to Shalmaneser, I think I'm going to go ahead and believe it. Okay, here's the Sennacherib cylinder. This is also in the British Museum. It looks like this giant thing, but it's actually only about this tall. The writing is tiny. It was created by Sennacherib. Sennacherib, who came a little bit later than Shalmaneser. All right. So this is around 150 years later. And it's a record of Sennacherib describing his conquest of Judah. And so what he says is, I went throughout Judah and I conquered 50 of its cities and took off massive plunder and many, many slaves. Then it says, and as for Hezekiah, I trapped him in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. Well, that's interesting. So what's he saying? Did he conquer or did he not conquer Judah? Well, what it says is, by the way, completely and absolutely consistent with the biblical record, which is he conquered all of Judah. He put Jerusalem under siege. And then that night, the destroying angel killed his entire army. Ah, that explains it. Why would the most powerful leader in the world at that time put Jerusalem under siege and then abandon the siege, leaving him, in quotes, like a bird in a cage? Basically, in this inscription, what he's admitting is he lost that battle. I believe we have indirect evidence of a miraculous event in the Old Testament. Proof, that would be a gross exaggeration. But I'd say we have indirect evidence of the miraculous event that's described in the Bible. I don't expect archaeologists to agree with that. That's not really their job. But I believe that. Here's the Siloam inscription. If you read in 2 Kings 20, you read about how Hezekiah built this tunnel in order to bring the water from the springs of Gihon into the city because he was preparing for the siege, by the way, the siege of Sennacherib. All right? And it's like, really? I mean, that would mean you'd have to have a tunnel like over half a mile long through solid rock. Nobody in the ancient world could have done something like that. Well, guess what they discovered? They discovered a tunnel underneath the city of Jerusalem, which goes from the Spring of Gihon, which is southeast of the city a little bit. And you, if you go to Jerusalem, you can actually walk through this tunnel that was built. And so what they did was one group started from inside the city by the near what we call the Pool of Siloam. The other group began in the spring, and something like 2,000 something feet through solid rock, and they met in the middle. And this is the inscription that was found at the meeting point. It's not there anymore. Obviously, that's not smart to leave it there. So it says, now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah's might and how he made the pool and the tunnel and all that. You know what? I think it's true. I think that Hezekiah is a real person. I believe he, along with Isaiah, did pray for deliverance from Assyria. And I believe that God did deliver him. Why? Because every single historical detail that you can check is completely consistent with what we know. So common sense says the things that we can't check almost certainly are in fact true. And unless somebody can show me the evidence to think differently, I'm sticking with it. Here's the siege of Lachish by the Assyrians. This is a horrible situation. In the Bible, the Babylonians were cruel. The Persians were relatively gentle, but the Assyrians were this horrible, horrendously cruel people. Well, history completely agrees with that, which makes the idea of Jonah going to Nineveh, and you know, you can see why he wasn't too fired up when they actually repented and God saved them. And you can see here are the ones with the beards, those are Jews being taken off in captivity after the destruction of Lachish. Here you can see, them being taken off into captivity. Here you can see Jews being flayed alive. So what they would do is they would capture Jews and they would skin them alive at the feet of the city in order to induce the Jews to finally submit, which they finally did. And again, if you read the account of the destruction of Lachish in the Old Testament, if you go to Nineveh, actually it's now in the British Museum. There's a whole room in the British Museum. You can tell how much I love the British Museum. All right, so I think when the Bible describes the destruction of Lachish by the Assyrians, I think it actually happened. When it describes the Ninevites, the Assyrians, as the most cruel of ancient people, I believe that as well. You have kind of like they left a record of their own cruelty, almost like what the Nazis did. You know what I'm saying? More stuff on Lachish. Babylonian Chronicles. Now, I think my case is kind of made already. I could keep giving you more evidence, but, you know, it's we're starting to get the idea here. So the Babylonian Chronicles, basically an account not of the final destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC, but an account of the first defeat of Jerusalem in 597 BC. This is an account by the Babylonian kings of that. In the seventh month, the year of Kislev, the king of Babylonia mustered his forces. He marched to Syria. He camped against the city of Judah. And on the second day of the month of Adar, he took the city, captured the king. He appointed a king in his place. And we know who that is. It's Zedekiah. So I'm beginning to think the things in Jeremiah, the things in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, I'm beginning to think that maybe that is what actually happened. All right, here's one of the Lachish letters. This is a pretty amazing thing. Now, the problem is you can get a little confusing because Lachish was destroyed by the Assyrians, all right, in 691 BC, but then it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 588 BC, immediately before Nebuchadnezzar put Jerusalem under siege. And this is a letter. It was found right at the city gate of Lachish. It's an ostraca, which means it's written on a clay shard. And the letter says essentially, please send soldiers because the light in Azekah just went out and we're next. And if they take us, they're going to take you as well. Well, if you go to Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7, you can see that First, Nebuchadnezzar took Azekah, and then Nebuchadnezzar took Lachish, and finally, as prophesied, if you will, by the person who wrote this letter, he finally took Jerusalem. And so the person who wrote this thing probably was dead within 24 hours of when he wrote it, and his letter was never delivered. And again, not only does this show the reliability of the Bible, but it also kind of puts, it kind of brings alive some of these stories in pretty awesome ways, or in this case, kind of scary ways. More of those. Here's an interesting one. If you read in Jeremiah, he describes how when Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiachin captive, he treated him like a member of a royal family. And they found, this is an actual thing found in Babylon, and I cannot read the script there, but apparently it's a list of supplies given to different people in the city, and one of the names on there, believe it or not, is Jehoiachin. And Jehoiachin is given four times greater food and stuff than anybody else, treated royally by Nebuchadnezzar, which is, why would he do that? I don't know, but he did. How do I know that? Well, you know what? Because the Bible says so. Isn't that good enough? Well, for those who don't think it's good enough, got some proof. It's true. And again, those who criticize the Bible as being unreliable history, they say, this, none of these has ever happened. You say, well, this one happened, okay, fine. 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 So are you starting to notice a pattern here? That all your things that never happened, like 40% of them, well, apparently they did happen. There's a pattern here. Every single thing we discover is consistent with the biblical record. And it's never in contradiction with the biblical record at all, ever. You would think people would start to notice this. By the way, it's not the job of the archaeologist, honestly, to tell you that the Bible is true. That's not really their job. Archaeologists, their profession requires a certain level of skepticism. And we need to give them space to be that as their archaeologists. We put on a whole conference on history, archaeology, and the Bible. We had a number of archaeologists from within our, the Restoration Movement. And my friend John Wilson, they'll caution us not to expect the archaeologists to get up there and say, yes, David killed Goliath. That's not their job. But I think what they ought to be able to do is say, look, the obvious, that if we want to look at an ancient record for reliable information on what actually happened, we should go not to Herodotus or Tacitus or, you know, these other people. They're fine as well. But the Bible is the best source that we have. They'll never say it. Okay, now we're back at the Ziggurat in Ur. And the reason is, this relates to the book of Daniel. If you go to Daniel chapter 5, there's the story about Daniel and Nabonidus. And Nabonidus, what he's doing, he's having this drunken party. And they're drinking out of cups taken from the Holy of Holies, taken from the temple in Jerusalem. God's not too fired up about that. They're drinking to the gods of wood and stone and iron, you know. So God, he puts the writing on the wall, right? Whatever. You know, the skeptics say, who could really believe in this finger, you know, in this writing on the wall? Besides, everybody knows that the last king of Babylon, it wasn't Belshazzar, it was Nabonidus. Herodotus says the last king was Nabonidus. Every Greek, Egyptian, whatever, all the historians said the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. But according to Daniel, the last king was Belshazzar. Further proof that you can't trust the Bible. And what Belshazzar said to Daniel in Daniel 5 is, anybody who can read the writing on the wall will get the third highest place in the kingdom. Why the third highest place? Well, they discovered an inscription in the Ziggurat in Ur. And in this inscription explained the whole situation. Because Nabonidus did a palace coup. and he had evil Merodach killed. He took the throne, but he was not legitimate heir. So his being the king of Babylon was illegitimate. But what he did was he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Smart move, right? Therefore, his son, and guess what his name was? Belshazzar. His son Belshazzar was therefore grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. So according to the inscription, what Nabonidus did was he had his son become a regent king, which stabilized his throne. And the evidence is Nabonidus was really not even involved in the government. By the time that Babylon was destroyed, was conquered by Cyrus in 538 BC, as recorded in great detail in Herodotus, by that time, Belshazzar had been an effective ruler for more than a dozen years. This does two things. First of all, it shows that of all ancient accounts regarding what was going on politically in Babylon at the time, guess what the most accurate account is? It's the biblical one. But it also explains why he offered the third highest place in the kingdom. Because who occupied the second highest place in the kingdom? The answer is Belshazzar. So this obscure detail, and you have to understand, if you read most scholars about Daniel, they'll say Daniel was written around 150 BC, which I believe is a bunch of nonsense. That is just totally not true. And it'll say, of course, it has all this stuff like, who's this Darius the Mede and who's this Belshazzar? Nobody could believe it. Well, I believe it. In fact, there's solid evidence that the book of Daniel relates actual things that actually happened. The Cyrus Cylinder. We could talk about the New Testament. I don't know how long I've been going. I've been going a bit long already. We could talk about Luke as a great historian. We could talk about, sure, probably this kind of crucifixion did happen. The Pool of Siloam really is an actual place. Caiaphas is an actual person who was the actual high priest at whose house the trial happened. And Corban, they really did say Corban, Matthew chapter 5. And Sir William Ramsay, who says Luke is a historian of the highest order. And Sergius Paulus is a real person. And Politarchs, that really was the name of kings in Thessalonica. And Gallio really is an actual person, etc. Erastus, and etc. Felix, and etc. So we can't prove the Bible, really, or the resurrection. We can't prove that Jesus is the Messiah or that God is real from history and archaeology. But what it does do is it gives us strong reason to believe the things that are described in the Old Testament, which we can't prove, which is actually most things. But also, I believe it's good evidence that the Bible is inspired by God, because all ancient histories were basically a bunch of lies with a few actual correct things mixed in there. None of them gave accounts of the defeats. They all had victories. So I believe this is evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. Okay, we'll take a couple of questions, and then we can do our groups. We could do it through chat or direct question, whatever you prefer.
Okay.
Questions, comments?
We have about 5 minutes for the questions, then at 8 o'clock we're going to break up into discussion groups, just fellowship groups by region.
Okay, I have a comment. Wow.
Technically, it's not a comment, but really amen.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Any thoughts or feedback or questions? Thanks, Keith. By the way, my camera's weird. I'm not, my skin is not red. It's close to the color of Rob, except Rob, you need to get in the sun more. You need a little bit more tan there. Okay.
I was just curious, is there any evidence that there was like a decline in Egypt around the Exodus? Because I'm assuming all those plagues,
Yeah, it's basically common knowledge. Actually, the decline was more like after 1200 BC. There were the Hyksos, the peoples of the sea, who attacked and conquered Egypt around 1100 BC. And those Hyksos are almost certainly the Philistines. All right, so there was that. And so that was a period of great chaos around 1150 BC to around 1000 BC. And then, of course, Nebuchadnezzar campaigned in Egypt. There's the Battle of Carchemish, the Battle of Carchemish, which happened in, 609 BC. That's the one that in which Josiah was killed. That's a well-known and documented battle. And that was essentially the final battle. After roughly 605 BC, the power of Egypt was destroyed, and Egypt was never a great empire after that. So the decline was, it was kind of like, you know, the graph is kind of like this. But the idea that there was a general decline of Egyptian power, really not until around 1250 BC or 1200 BC. Yeah, that's confirmed, not just by archaeological evidence, but even by other historical records. Yes. Yeah.
I read an article a few years ago, I think it was, that apparently they actually found evidence of chariots on the bottom of the Sea of Reeds or the Red Sea.
That has been completely discredited. That guy is a liar.
Okay.
He is a flat-out liar.
Okay.
I don't know if you know Rex Geisler. He's a friend of mine. He was the one who published my first couple of books. And he actually knows this guy. He met him, and he said, "Why do you publish this kind of garbage?" And the guy said, "Well, a guy has to make money somehow."
Yeah.
And he's a stain on Christianity. So I don't know whether he threw a chariot and just took a picture. I'm forgetting the guy's name. I've forgotten his name. But this guy is a complete liar, and nothing he says can be. He says he discovered the Noah's Ark and all this stuff. So you got to be really. I said that you got to be really careful. All right, things that I use are things that you can go to the British Museum. You know what I'm saying? And for example, there's the James Ossuary that came out probably about 18 or 20 years ago, and this supposedly was the bone box of James, the brother of Jesus. And when it came out, everybody's excited. A lot of people are announcing it on the internet. And I'm like, I just didn't say anything. I kept quiet because I had a feeling. And I said to myself, I need to wait for a few years and we'll see how it goes. And it turns out that was also a forgery.
Thank you for clearing that up.
All right. Yeah. Rex Geisler or Ron Wyatt?
No, the one that
you're
talking about.
Ron Wyatt? That's his name. It's Ron Wyatt, I think. No, it's somebody Wyatt. Anyway, yeah, well, he's still at it, apparently. He has no shame.
A wagon wheel from one of the wagons. He's got it in his house right now.
Yeah. First of all, the Israelites didn't have chariots. Oh, they're claiming it's the Egyptians. But anyway, this is really quite ridiculous, quite silly.
I was in the Museum of the Book of the Bible in Jerusalem, and going through, and I saw these Roman coins, gold coins, found by John Wilson.
Yes. Oh, he told the story. It's a great story. Do you know John Wilson?
Very well.
Yeah. So he was there, and there was some young lady from Sweden or somewhere in Europe. She was just there and she said, "Can I work for you?" Is there, I guess. She just wanted to volunteer. He didn't even know her. And she was there for a few days. So he put her in a place that he thought, well, at least she can't do any damage. And sure enough, she found this cache of like hundreds of gold coins, which would be worth probably millions of dollars. And she pulls it out. He almost fainted right on the spot. It's a great story. Yeah.
Hey, John, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Sure.
Go ahead and bring them into our discussion groups. I guess we're not going to see you next week for the fourth and final installment.
Sorry about that, yeah. But it'll be a great lesson.
Yes, let's get John a group again. Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to go ahead and break up into our discussion groups, and those will go until a little bit before 8:30. Have a great time. They're going to be generally by region.
See y'all later.